what I say. Cause the world is getting smaller each passing day.
Jesus.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we kicked the show off, or we came out of the blocks today with the music of the original Wailers, a music lesson. And that, of course, featured Robert Nestor Marley and Bunny Wailer, and the original Wailers also included a young man by the name of Walde Semayat, who the world knows as Peter Tosh, and Junior Brathwaite. And Junior Brathwaite is no longer in the land of the living, and next week we're going to be playing a song from the original Wailers, which will feature Peter, Junior Brathwaite, and Bunny Wailer. But we have an exciting show for you today, a very, very exciting show for you today. We're going to be speaking with Akinyele Umoja at 2:30, and he has a great book out called We Will Shoot Back, about the resistance movement in Mississippi. And we're going to be speaking with a young man by the name of Habib Koita, who is a brother from Mali, who I had a 45-minute interview with. He speaks English probably better than me, and French, and of course he speaks the languages of Mali. But we're going to be speaking with him at 3 o'clock, and we have a special interview with some forces from the Uhuru, from Epidom, pardon me. And well, first of all, we would like to send condolences out to Bunny Ruggs of Third World. He passed away, and he was a Facebook book friend of ours. And we actually met Bunny Ruggs many, many times. And we, when I say we, I'm speaking of the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition, a group that existed in Toronto, Canada. We fought around the whole question of apartheid in South Africa, and we gave an award to Third World, and there is a picture. If you go on Facebook, you can see a picture of Third World and myself giving the award to Third World, and it just so happens that Bunny is holding the award, and he has his head down. But right now, we want to continue with our great show. Well, we can't say it's great. That's you have to make that. That has to be your decision whether it's great or not. But we wanted to go back and start Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio with Marvelous Marvin Gaye.
I just want to ask a question. Who really cares? Save a world in despair. Who really cares? There'll come a time.
There'll come a time
when the world won't be singing.
When the world won't be singing.
Flowers won't grow. Bells won't be ringing.
No bells won't be ringing.
Who really cares?
Who really cares?
Who's willing to try?
Who is willing to try?
To save a world.
To save a world.
That's destined to
that
die.
That is destined to die.
When I look at the world,
when I look at the world,
it fills me with sorrow.
It fills me with sorrow.
Little children today,
children today,
really gonna suffer tomorrow.
Really suffer tomorrow.
Oh, what a shame.
What a shame.
Such a bad way to
such
live.
Such a bad way to live.
Oh, who is to blame?
Who is to blame?
We can't stop
when
living.
We can't stop living. Oh, oh.
Live.
Live.
Live. Live.
Live for life.
Live for life. But let live, everybody.
Live life. For the children.
Live life for the children. Oh, for the children.
You see, let's save the children. Let's save all the children.
Save the babies. Save the babies. And if you want to live, but who really cares? Who's willing to try? Yeah, to save our world. Yeah, save our sweet world. Save a world that is destined to die.
Nanga Def to all of my, or all of our listeners who speak Wolof, the folks from Senegal. Nanga Def is a greetings in Wolof. And we were listening to the music of Millie Jackson, Regina Bell, and Marvin Gaye. And Regina Bell started out with the Manhattans, and there was a beautiful edition of Unsung, which Regina Bell was on. And we interviewed Gerald Alston and Blue Lovett of the Manhattans. I know you can remember that. And they talked about Regina Bell, how they discovered Regina Bell. And Millie Jackson did Someday We'll All Be Free. And Sister Livia, sister out of who does a lot of work with Diasporic Music and Uhuru Radio, she discovered that rendition of Someday We'll All Be Free. I didn't even know that existed. But right now, we wanted to play, as the Jamaicans would say, a little bit of Bunny Ruggs. We're going to do a tribute to Bunny Ruggs. We did a whole lot of work around Bunny Ruggs, like I say, on Facebook. But we're going to play Now That We Found Love, which was a song that was written by Kenny Gamble. Mr. Gamble, my leader and teacher, who was the head of the co-founder of the Black Music Association. He founded the Black Music Association with a young man by the name of Ed Wright. And after that, we're going to be speaking with Akinyele Umoja, the author of We Will Shoot Back. But let us pay tribute now to Bunny Ruggs and Third World. Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we just heard a little bit of Bunny Ruggs and Third World, and we're going to be paying tribute to Bunny Ruggs, put my foot in my mouth, next week. And joining us on the line from Atlanta, Georgia, is Akinyele Omowale Umoja, and he is the author of a great book, We Will Shoot Back, from Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement, and he's also Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Georgia State University, and he teaches a number of classes there. First of all, welcome to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. How are you doing today?
Man, I'm doing great, and it's good to be on your show, and even though it's through the airwaves, in your presence.
Well, you know something, I wanted to say something before we started the interview. I wanted to take you and everybody back to 1964 and talk about Compton and South Central.
Wow.
Because at that particular time in 1964, I went to John C. Fremont. Did you go to Compton High School?
Went to Compton High. I graduated in 72.
All right, now.
I had relatives who went to Fremont.
Now, what happened in 1964 was that John C. Fremont had produced a young man by the name of Richard Stebbins, and Compton High School produced a man by the name of Ulysses Williams.
Right.
From Mississippi. Now, they both won gold medals in the relay. They both ran third legs of the relays in Tokyo. Richard ran the third leg of the 4x400, and he ran the third leg, gave the baton to Bob Hayes. They brought home gold, and Ulysses ran the third leg, and he passed the baton on, and they brought home gold. So that was like a unity thing for African. I was 17, 18, but I remember I went to school with Richard, and that was one of the proud moments that we had, you know, coming up in Los Angeles, and Compton in Los Angeles, same places, just little suburb stuff, but
right.
I just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah, Ulysses Williams was one of those names when I was growing up. In 1964, I was 10,
right.
And he was one of those names that we would hear growing up of people we should look up to.
Right.
Yeah, he was a great track star.
I understand he was a great academic man too. He ran one of the colleges in Los Angeles. Is that true?
I think so. Yeah. Member serves me correct. He was
right.
An educator also.
Now let us talk about what brought about We Will Shoot Back. You know, why would you even write a book like that?
Man, that's several influences, and you know, in the beginning of the book, I tell the story about how my dad, who grew up in the Mississippi Delta in Bolivar County, it's called Alligator, Mississippi. He used to tell me a story about how when his family, which was a sharecropping family, saw a black man's body hanging from a water tower, and how my grandfather grabbed a gun and he was going to shoot the first white person he saw. And the family tackled him and disarmed him. And, you know, I had, you know, like ambivalent feelings about that story, because on one hand, I was proud of my grandfather, because growing up, I never heard stories of black people resisting or fighting back, particularly in the South. And on the other hand, I felt the terrorism in my family. As I grew and became active in the movement, when I was 18 years old, I became active in the last leg of the Black Power Movement in Los Angeles. And I would hear stories about the Deacons for Defense, Robert Williams, people like that in the South and Louisiana. And, of course, Robert Williams was in North Carolina, who resisted. And then I would meet activists from the South, and they would begin to tell me these stories. Two people in particular, Walter Collins, who was with the Southern Conference Educational Fund, SCEF, also with SNCC, who was a draft resistor. And his mother, Dara Bubakari, who was with the Republic of North Africa, she was the daughter of Garveyites. And she began to tell me these stories about people in the South resisting. In fact, even before that, I met the great Queen Mother Moore, and she talked to us about how black people came out and forced the police to back down so they could hear Garvey speak in New Orleans.
That was in New Orleans, right?
Yeah, Queen Mother used to tell that story all the time. And so, you know, I had all these stories in my head, and then when I began graduate school, I decided to write a paper on resistance in the South. One of my professors said it'd be a great dissertation, so that started me on this research process. What even built it even further is when I traveled to Mississippi and I talked to activists who were begging to tell these stories, right? They felt like, you know, that their history in the South, our legacy and the legacy of the movement there has not been really told right. And so they told me a lot of these stories of resistance. And I tell you the truth, I've heard even more since the book is out, you know, people approaching me with stories. I kind of feel like this book will lead to other stories and uncovering of other events that happened in our movement amongst our people to defend themselves. Even people telling me stories about their own families, even that predate the civil rights movement. So I'm hoping it'll be a catalyst for us to begin to discuss our history and who we really are as a people.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm speaking with Akinyele Umoja, the author of We Will Shoot Back. And my grandmother was born in Louisiana, and I had the pleasure and honor of meeting my great-grandparents who were from Mississippi. They were Glovers, and and my mother, my grandmother always told me the story how her some young white guys came by wanting to purchase my great-grandfather's guns. And, you know, they said, he said it was no way he was going to give them up. So they said, you know, old man, we are, you know, we ought to take you and basically make a move on you. So the story goes, my grandfather told me, you know, like, you know, age is nothing but a number, you know, and they got, they said, this Ian is crazy. And they left, you know, they left him alone. But he was, I had all kinds of stories about, and the last time I saw my grandmother, she passed away on Marcus Garvey's birthday in 1983. But the last time I saw her, she was sitting out on the porch, and she told me to look up under there, and she had a pistol, and she says, I'm ready, you know, anybody come mess with me. I feel, you know, I'm cool. So I know what you're talking about in terms of that Mississippi thing.
Right. And so those type of stories and that type of legacy is all over the South, but that's not generally what's portrayed when we talk about our movement or folk in the South. And you know, that's not the narrative we get. And
right.
So, again, I hope this book is an intervention in helping to change that notion.
Now, how has the book been received in terms of what type of press have you got reviews from, the first of all, from our press, and have you got any kind of support from the alternative and the corporate press?
Not much in the corporate press. Publishers Weekly did publish a review of it that was positive, and I've only received positive reviews so far. And I'm expecting there's been some academic journals who are starting to publish reviews of it, all positive, but mostly in the alternative press and is where I've been getting reviews. When you say alternative, I'm saying progressive, left-oriented.
That's what I'm talking about. Right.
Black-oriented press, a grassroots press. That's where that's what's been the life of this book. And I've had a pretty busy schedule since the last fall. Just virtually every week I'm doing a book signing somewhere in the United States. And so it's really like a grassroots, even though it's published by academic press. Since I'm an academic, it's published by New York University Press. But the lifeblood of this book is our grassroots communities and activists and people like that who've invited me to come to their communities and speak. I've been to Baltimore. I've been to New York 3 times. I've been to California, Northern and Southern California. I've actually going back to California at the end of this month.
I don't want to cut you, but did you speak at
Esalen?
I wanted to give them a plug.
Okay, Esalen was packed. Part for one of the reasons Esalen was packed, though, because I'm from Southern California. My family, my relatives there, my in-laws were there, but as well as a lot of people from the movement, but a lot of community people who I didn't know came since I've been going from Los Angeles now for 29 years. It was a strong turnout. It was packed. It was standing room only in SNY. And we're going to do a workshop in the Southern California Library when I go back.
Southern California Library, that's on Normandy, right?
Normandy, I think Vermont.
Vermont, right.
Right in South Central Los Angeles. So we're going to do something there.
Right.
It'll be more of a workshop when I do this type of research. As well as I'll be speaking in UCLA, which is funny. I went there as a freshman. I dropped out. That's when I became more active in the movement. At that time, I didn't see my way through that type of education. I wanted to get an education in the community. And whereas it could be a mistake on some levels, I discourage young people from dropping out of college today. But I felt like I needed to get an education in the hood from the movement at that time. And that's what's enabled me to do this type of research today. So, who knows?
You're listening
because of people like you that left a foundation for me to be able to do that type of work and learning.
Well, Los Angeles, could you talk about, for the listeners, in terms of when we talk about L.A., we're essentially talking about people that came from Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas, and Oklahoma. I think the majority of African people in Los Angeles, when I was growing up, the majority, I believe, came from Louisiana and Texas. I don't know. I always wanted to know who, was there more people from Louisiana, more people from Texas? But Mississippi, the great filmmaker who we've had on this show, Charles Burnett, he was born in Mississippi. And let me give him a plug. Charles Burnett did a film on Namibia, which is one of the greatest films you could ever see. Carl Lumdy played Sammy Nyomo, and it has Garvey in the film, talks about, shows Sammy Nyomo when he's in Namibia. They're talking about Garvey then, and he comes to New York, and they talk about Garvey, but let me shut up and let you answer the question.
I'm going to track that film down, but no, you're right. Los Angeles, at the time I was growing up, it had a great diaspora that came from Louisiana. I mean, if you think about it, Bunchy Carter, who founded Southern California Black Panther Party, he was from Louisiana, Shreveport.
Right.
And then you got Geronimo G. Jaga, or Geronimo Pratt, who came to assist him. He was from Morgan City, Louisiana. But you also had people from Arkansas, Texas, particularly East Texas. You had my mother was from Oklahoma, but her people were from Northern Louisiana. And you had several from Mississippi. And it affected the culture of L.A. too. If you think about it, when I was growing up, there were all these local little fish places. You buy, we fry. And most of them were Louisiana and had a Louisiana style of cooking fish, And I remember the fish fries and things folks used to have. So,
they still got that.
Right. And a lot of our people, when I was growing up, and of course when you were there even before, came because of Firestone and other industries that were there for our people to come, and we worked there. Our fathers worked in many of those places. My uncles worked in many of those places. And unfortunately, those industries, that manufacturing base that was there adjacent to South Central LA is no longer there. It started to decline when I was in high school. And that's when you see, like, the LA that people talk about today, the South Central LA and the Compton, people talk about the day that came about, who was really promoted through NWA, Ice Cube, and other groups. That LA came because of the destruction of that manufacturing base to a large extent.
You're exactly right, because my father and grandfather worked for R.H. Osbrink, and that was right. Mm. Where was the blimp at, the plant?
I think it was like Slauson near Central.
Yeah, but was that Firestone?
It was Firestone. I'm saying Slauson, but I'm trying. Yeah, it was Slauson near Central. And I know my grandmother lived not too far from there. She's been staying off the Central.
Well, my father worked at R.H. Osbrink, and my grandfather got his son a job there, and then my Uncle Prentice, who's from Louisiana, he used to go back down south and bring people from Louisiana to California, and my grandfather got all of them jobs, you know, at R.H. Osbrink. So you're absolutely right, and then when the manufacturing thing and the movement was crushed.
Exactly.
We really, African people in Los Angeles, I guess it's not just Los Angeles, but we're just talking about Los Angeles. When that manufacturing thing was crushed, we all kind of negativity set in.
Yeah, no, that was significant. I mean, because after that, you get the increase in the drug traffic. You get, like a destabilization of the economy of a lot of our homes, things of that nature. And like you said, with the crushing of the movement, because when I was growing up, again, I was by 69, I would have been 15 years old. And during that period of time, you had the attack. That later in that year, you'd have the attack on the Black Panther Party. The conflict in Los Angeles, in South Central LA. You would have the conflict between the Panther Party and US organization, which was a part of a COINTELPRO type of operation, the divide and conquer type organization that really destabilized the movement. But you also had the arrest of Geronimo, other leaders like that. And at the same time, you saw the rise of other street forces, particularly the Crips and the Bloods, as you had the attack on the movement. And so, and with this destabilization that was happening through the decline of manufacturing, a lot of young people are attracted to that, and there's no real employment like it was before. So you have the advance of the drug trade. So it's really a complicated scenario that develops the South Central that we know of, that's really become popularized through the movie industry and through hip-hop music. But that was a transition from a community that could birth, like, the Black Panther Party, the Malcolm X Foundation, us, all that Black Power movement that occurred during that time. And I remember growing up in a community, people were very identified with that. I'm talking about young people when I was in high school. So our consciousness was a lot different than what I see now. When I go out there in a few weeks, I hope to talk to some high school age youth. But I think their reality is completely different from the reality I grew up in, I believe. And so I think it's a necessary.
I spent 8 months out there. Sorry for cutting you. Go ahead.
Pardon?
No, I said sorry. What'd you say? But I just spent 8 months in California, so I think when you go out there, you will be in darkened by it's different.
Right. No, it is different. I go out there oftentimes because I still have family there, and the whole energy and feeling of it is different. And so we're going to have to do a lot of work. And what I see there is just kind of like also what you see around the country. But right. We got to really try to make some interventions, and we got to really work with our youth and protect our youth. You know, yesterday we had the verdict in the case of Dunn with the killing of Jordan Russell Davis. And, you know, when we really think about this and reconnect with the book, you know, the people I wrote about in Mississippi, the reason that they were able to resist is you had a lot of community connection. You had a lot of networks that were established in our communities, and you had a sense of solidarity and unity. And so, like, when there was when home was being bombed in the civil rights movement, the community as a whole would respond. It wouldn't just be that family. And so we got to rebuild that. I think this verdict in the Dunn case, as well as the case of Zimmerman, it kind of really shows us that in our communities in the United States and North America, that the cavalry is not coming and our lives aren't really valued, that we need to begin to, like, organize our communities, our neighborhoods, and we need to develop the necessary type consciousness where we can protect our children. Right now, the lives of our children and the value of our humanity is a serious question. And so, I'll make that argument that right now we got to really rebuild certain type of networks in our community so we can protect and defend ourselves. And when I say protect and defend, I'm not just talking about with guns. I'm talking about we got to be able to pool our resources so our children can eat. We got to be able to create institutions to make sure our children are educated, also to be able to technologically deal with the society they live in and can think critically, and as well as, you know, not be able to depend on the people who are currently running this society, who really the plans are for us, you know what I mean? In the 1950s, when Paul Robeson and William Patterson and others said we charge genocide, that's a reality that we have to look at right now. And so I think the book should be timely from that point of view, that it talks about the need for where people actually took the protection of their communities in their own hands.
Now, when you talk about protecting the community, you just clarified you're not only talking about self-defense from a military point of view. You're talking about education and the whole...
We got it. Exactly.
Feeding yourself, self-determination.
Exactly. We have to have a form of self-determination. It was a slogan from the 60s from the Black Power Movement. Is self-determination, self-respect, self-defense. And I think those things are necessary. That's something we have to revisit. We have to become more self-reliant. We have to begin to develop institutions in our community to protect us on all different levels, protect our minds. And so, yeah, so I'm talking about something that's comprehensive. Because if we don't have the type of, I think it's just having a sense of community and peoplehood that's necessary. Why do I say that? It's because right now, as opposed to the people I wrote about in Mississippi in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s, the sense of connection and community is not as high. And so, for instance, my wife gave me this example. She said, what if Trayvon, who was on the phone with his friend Rachel, what if he could have said to her, this creepy man is following me. Call my father. Call, you know, the community. Call our friends. And people came, his neighbors came and had his back. It might have been a different story that night.
It could have been the same thing that happened like in L.A. when they, you know, the community came out when they had the shootout in L.A. The community basically, they couldn't move on the Panthers the way they wanted to because there was so much support from the community. So I know exactly.
What
happened. Right.
The same thing happened in New Orleans when the Panthers were attacked. And so many people came out in the projects and had the back of the Black Panther Party, and they had to negotiate with them out of that situation. So
same thing happened in St. Petersburg, too, in terms of they had a little battle, not a little, big battle in St. Petersburg. But we only have 5 minutes left. This is my proposal to you. Since we only scratched the surface, and unlike commercial radio, I can program what I want. I'd like to invite you back next week, if that's possible.
Next week, that's the 23rd?
Yes, sir.
What is next? I might be traveling that day. Let's communicate this week. I got to see what my flight arrangements are and stuff because I'm headed to California.
Okay.
Heading to California next Sunday. I think I'm flying that day. So we'll try to work it out. I would love to come back on this show, though.
Yeah,
particularly out of respect of you and your long-standing work.
Would you? Yeah, well, I'm a rookie at this thing too. But I really wanted to talk to you about. I met Queen Mother Moore. I had the honor of meeting, you know, Queen Mother Moore and spending a little bit of time with her. And I spent a little time with Maxwell Curtis Stanford Jr.
That's one of my leaders. That's one of my big brothers and fathers in this movement. So
right.
Most
so
definitely.
Maxwell. He lets me call. Well, he calls himself that. Everybody. He uses both names, Maxwell Sanford as well as Muhammad Ahmed. But yeah. Well, so we have a lot of things to really talk about in that home. We didn't even touch the Mississippi Freedom Movement, but I think people, we need to revisit that because a lot of people need to know about 63 and that whole situation as well.
Yes, sir. I'll be willing to come back. We'll just work out the time.
All right, sir. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I appreciate the support people have gotten for the book. If you want to pick it up, it's at NYU Press. You can also get it on Amazon or just contact me directly or whatever. And, keep up the good work.
Last question. In terms of the black bookstores, we have in Los Angeles, Esalen, I guess we still have Marcus Garvey in San Francisco.
Marcus in the Bay Area, yes, sir.
Right. And what do you have? Ebon Dooley was a good friend of mine. He was in Atlanta. He passed away. He had a great bookstore at one time. I think, what was Ebon's bookstore called?
Was it Timbuktu?
Timbuktu, here
in Atlanta. It was actually closed. I knew Ebon, but the bookstore was closed by the time I moved here.
Right.
Right now, Madu, which is in Greenbrier Mall, southwest Atlanta, is one of the only black-owned bookstores. We had five at one time. Now we're down to that one. There's one, I don't know about this, in the outlying areas of South Atlanta. I think it's called Nubian Bookstore.
Right.
I haven't been there yet and talked to them folks over there yet. But no, the black bookstore is very challenged right now. And I think a lot of that is a reflection of our consciousness. The people I knew had bookstores, they had to start relying on a lot of books with a lot of fluff, as I would call it.
A lot of black love stories, like the Black Housewives, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Or street, or gangster tales, or something, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of fictional things of that nature. And I think you could even use, I have a student, Jahad Uhuru, who uses some of that genre to raise consciousness. But I think he's like a minority amongst the people publishing that arena.
All right, my brother, it's 2:59, and we have run out of time, and I really appreciate it. And if we can work it out, we'll definitely bring you back.
All right, keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.
All right, peace.
All right, you have been listening to Akinyele Uwoja, the author of We Will Shoot Back, and Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio continues.
You're listening to uhururadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Hey, Aisha, hold on. I'll walk with you. You know, this is going to be a great class.
I know. Yet I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow, sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up today.
And hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist, coming to you from the not-so-great White North. And we have Yishinde, who is the director of operations at IMPIDOM, and IMPIDOM, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, and that is the mass organization, one of the mass organizations of the African People's Socialist Party. And Yishinde is based in Newark, New Jersey. How are you doing?
Uhuru, Uhuru, comrade.
How are you doing?
Uhuru. Glad to be on the show. Glad to be on the show. I listen to it all the time.
Oh, I appreciate that. Now, you are based in Newark, and could you talk about what's happening with IMPIDOM next week? You guys are doing a special broadcast.
Yes, on the weekend of February 22nd and 23rd, we want everyone to clear their calendar and be part of the Pledge of Resistance telethon. We'll have Africans from three continents, you know, and we'll show what IMPIDOM, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, is doing on the ground and on the grounds in those continents. So we'll have our comrades actually reporting. It's also a telethon where, you know, raising funds for our upcoming international convention of IMPIDOM. And this is also a membership drive. So we'll be winning members to the organization as well through this telethon. And it's very exciting to putting it together and being part of it and just watching it, you know, turn into something. So I really want all the listeners to your show, Norman, to, you know, come out and take the pledge of African resistance with IMPIDOM.
Now, the three continents. What are the three continents? Europe, Africa, and
Europe, North America, and Africa, and we're all over. But this is who's reporting. We'll be reporting on North America Europe and Africa this coming weekend.
Now, where is the Uhuru movement based in Africa and in Europe?
In Sierra Leone in Africa, and we're in Europe. We're in London, and we're also in Sweden.
We got a nice post
in Stockholm
from Sia, the sister in Sweden, and she put something up on Facebook, and she's been a big supporter of diasporic music on Uhuru Radio and the Uhuru movement and the African People's Socialist Party. So I really like to thank her.
That's Conrad. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, briefly, what type of mass work does IPDOM do?
Well, IPDOM is the mass organization, and we lead the masses in revolutionary struggle is basically what we do. We want to open up our campaign, our newest campaign, which is the dual and contending power campaign, where we want to create survival programs. It's based off of the dollar is crashing. The United States dollar is crashing. I mean, when you listen to CNN and MSNBC and all the financial reports, they don't say, like, if the dollar crashes anymore. They say when it crashes. So IPDOM, with the dual and contending power program, we want to use this opportunity as an offensive against imperialism, say, hey, we don't, trust this system. We're going to create our own systems to protect and defend our people, and also make sure that our people in our communities have food and shelter and know how to survive, a dollar crash or any type of situation where, emergency situation, I should say. So that's just one of the campaigns that we've been working on IPDOM. And also just reporting on and keeping abroad, revolutionary struggle in all the cities where we located, against police brutality, against school closings, and just making offense against colonialism and imperialism everywhere.
All right, sir. I really appreciate it, and I hope everyone listens next week, and we would like to stay in touch with you, and if you could send me your information through Facebook or email, and we'd definitely like to stay in touch and bring you back on at another point.
Okay. All right, my brother.
Thank you.
It just sucks. All right. Uhuru.
And we are going to continue with diasporic music on Uhuru Radio. We're going to go to L.A. by way of Bamako, Mali, and this is a young man who was in Toronto, Canada, Friday night, who tore the joint up, and he wrote this song about L.A., and this is Brother Habib. I had a 45-minute interview with this young man, but let's listen to Habib right now saying about L.A.
Tarata majana Sira janya janya Inasi L.A. Sira janya janya L.A. for Los Angeles. Eriki Abibi Dori ni Daniele Antara L.A. for Los Angeles.
L.A.
for Los Angeles. One shot, two shot, three shot, four shot, five.
Tequila, tequila make me happy.
Kanakululu ye Bamako, imbe ye kelenye for Los Angeles. Nesokelu ye San Diego, Canada pelu ye Menaka, imbe ye kelenye for Los Angeles. Salina Kanati le minye nara Nibe ikilenye For Los Angeles For Los Angeles Yeah. One shot, two shot, three shot, four shot, five.
Tequila, tequila make me happy. Tequila, el tequila time. Tequila, tequila make me happy. Tequila, el tequila
California, Kanakululu ye Bamako, Nimbe ye kilenye, for Los Angeles. Nye sokelu ye San Diego, Canada felu ye Menaka, Nimbe ye kilenye, for Los Angeles. Maduka misilu be Madison, kana misilu ye Masina, nimbe ye kelenye for Los Angeles. One shot, two shot, three shot, four shot, five.
Tequila.
I'm speaking to, how do I pronounce your last name, Habib?
The last name is Kouate.
Kouate.
Yes, exactly.
And you are from the beautiful country of Mali. And when I was growing up, I used to admire, one of my heroes was Modibo Keita. I guess he was the first prime minister of Mali, and he
the first president.
Yes, first president. I'm living in Canada, so I'm getting all mixed up. But could you talk about your new CD? It's called So, I believe. That means home in English.
Yeah, it's So is the name of the new album. I give this name so is meaning homeland or house or country, my country. And I give this name. I make a song about the situation of Mali since those 3 last year, the crisis Mali crisis, we know during 3 years. Is why I got the album So, and to tell how to keep a sweet our homeland, to tell to the people, Malian people, what they know. They know that, but I tell again, please, we have to take care of our homeland to make it sweet.
Are you still, did you leave Mali, or are you living in Mali? And there was a time when you couldn't record. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, I live in Mali. I live in Bamako.
You never left?
Never left Mali. Never. If not home, I'm on tour.
You never left home, but you could not record at in Mali at one time, right? The government who came in, they tried to stop music. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes. It was two sides. The north side, the musician wasn't allowed to make music, in the south, in Bamako, they make a coup d'état and a lot of politics cries, and the coup d'état and then the military was a fight between them. And there, they say to stop music. It's not only music to stop all where the people are together. No, they don't. Okay, people are not allowed to be a lot together. No
right.
Music, no concert, no. Yes, it's a, I don't know the good word in English. Yes, those the two side was happened the same time, and it's why in the whole country no music. to record something, people can record, you know, to be in a studio. Yes, we can do this
right
because I record all of my songs in Mali, in my house at home, and at this time, but we are at home. We are in a studio. We don't do too much noise, and it's not. We are not a lot. Just some musicians come and go. We can record.
Right. Oh, okay. Now, because Bamako is in the south. Bamako is a city that we always heard about when I was growing up. There's a lot of people in the Western Hemisphere. We know about the Mali Empire. We know about, Ghana and those situations. But I've been recently seeing a lot of musicians from Mali, and there's a lot of, you play a guitar, and the kora is real big in Mali. And the Ngoni, I believe, is really like the father of the guitar and the banjo. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, the kora first is an instrument Malian people use it since Mandinka Empire, some 12 cycle century ago, the Mandinka Empire, the griot used the kora to sing, and the storyteller used kora to tell story through the music sound of the kora. And the Mandinka Empire was cover of the whole West Africa. A lot of the big musician kora player come from Mali, but some come from come from Senegal too, from Casamance, from Gambia, and from Guinea too. Yeah, all those countries was like was a part of Mandinka Empire, but Mali was the heart of Mandinka Empire. And Ngoni is another instrument who stay together like a friend of kora. They all was used by Creole or storyteller to accompany to the music or the song or the story they tell. The banjo is very close to the ngoni.
The first ngoni was
just one string, but after he become four, and actually some young put on the ngoni some seven or six string, but the fourth string was the special one. And the sound is very close to the banjo, and actually I have a banjo in a band. And this banjo was a gift of Eric Bieber, my big brother. He gave to me this banjo, and I make some song with the banjo.
Right.
I want to tell you about it. Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead. You'll finish your story. I'm sorry for cutting you off. Go ahead.
I just to tell you about the two instruments, kora and ngoni. A lot of big virtues who actually are passing away. Some come from Gambia and Casamance, and some come from Mali. But a new generation now come out take those instruments and play it very, very well. It's why I call in the song Terere, my song Terere, I call the name of it. Tumani Jabate, and I call, and Tumani is coming to play, and I call Basiku Kiyate too. He's coming to play to celebrate the ngoni and those instruments.
Basuku is how do you pronounce his name?
Basiku Kiyate.
Kiyate. I just saw him in Toronto 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Okay. Say hello to him again if you see him.
He did a beautiful concert and. He really brought, we can really see that the blues is really, I saw Ali Fakar Touré before I met him, and so I know that, there is a link between the music in Mali and the blues.
Yeah.
But,
hello.
You did a song called L.A. I was born, I grew up in L.A., and, I really get a kick out of listening to that song. It sounds like you really were impressed by L.A.
Oh, yes, it's a song. I am a griot. Griot in Mali is a man who know the family tree. He know the name of family, and he know who come from where. And he know he's storyteller, and he can tell someone the name of his grandfather, his father, and his ancestor, because he know the story. He know who come from where, about the family, like the family name. And okay, I am a griot too, and I just love, fall in love to the city of LA. And through the song, I celebrated the city, and I compare a lot of city, and I say, LA is the best. I talk, I sing about the horse of Spina, of the hill in California, and I say, okay, in the hill of Bamako, we have a hill in Bamako, around Bamako is a hill, and we have a river who crosses the city in Bamako, city of Bamako, a beautiful city, and I compare, but I say LA is the best. And many people ask me about tequila. I say, no, I don't celebrate tequila, but I celebrate LA to tequila.
Did you go through, did you go to Baldwin Hills when you went to LA?
Say again?
Did you go to Baldwin Hills? Baldwin Hills used to be like the black Beverly Hills. That's where a lot of, I think Denzel Washington lived there at one point. It's not what it used to be, but it was like the black Beverly Hills at one point.
Oh, no, I've never been there. Oh, I want to go there. There is the house of Denzel Washington in this place.
No, Denzel used to live there at one time, but, you know, after, yeah, Baldwin Hills was like the black Beverly Hills. Beverly Hills is where the rich.
Beverly Hills.
Right, yeah.
Yes, I want to see this place. No, I've never been there.
Uh-huh.
And the next time I hope...
I'm sorry, I cut you off.
I ask my friend to bring me there.
Right. You mentioned San Diego. San Diego is a very beautiful spot, too.
Yeah, because this song is about L.A., but is about California, too. I like California in the whole state, you know, all state here. California is the state I like. It's something simple because sun and not too much, it's sunny and not too much cold. In this tour, we was in San Francisco. We start in San Francisco. It was good, just little fresh, but no snow, nothing. And after 1 week after we move to the north, we get too much cold, too much. We see too much in snow. And I love California because this. The climate mm-hmm. is good, and I celebrate LA in California. It's why I sing in the song. I say San Diego, Salina. The name of Salina is. I hear the name of Salina maybe 3 years ago. In a movie, and in Mali. 3 years, 3-5 years ago, and I travel and I come to Salina. People tell me this is Salina, and it was really like if your dream become reality, and I see really Salina.
Nanga Def, that is the language of Senegal. But this brother is from Mali, and we were listening to Habib, and he's getting ready to sing a song with Eric Bibb. Now, Eric Bibb is the son of Leon Bibb, and Eric Bibb is the his godfather is Paul Robeson, and his uncle was John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet, and his family friends included people like Pete Seeger. And Leon Bibb is still alive in Vancouver right now, and he was a very progressive person. But right now we wanted to listen to Eric Bibb and our brother from Mali. So let us listen to another song.
Mm-hmm. love to fly first class. Someone else pays the ticket. We love our juicy fruit, long as we don't have to pick it. We love our fast food, don't care about heart attacks. We love to gossip, don't care about the facts. We want the gold, long as we don't have to mine it. Don't care who suffers or who's behind it. We want the cool running shoes, don't care who made them. Don't care if they go to school. We want the cheap gasoline, jump in the car and go. Don't care what the world agreed upon in Kyoto. We ought to all save water, but we don't even try. Take 30 minute showers while the well runs dry. We don't care, we don't care, we don't care. We don't care, we don't care, we don't care. Everything we need, but we still want more. We don't care, we don't care, we don't care. We don't care, we don't care, we don't care. We don't care, we don't care, we don't care.
Listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Ilali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in, and we are in the midst of interviewing Habib from Mali, and had a 45-minute interview with this young man, and he's very interesting. He puts on a great show. And you just listened to him perform with Eric Gibb, We Don't Care, and a very serious message in that particular song. It is really an indictment of a lifestyle that many of us in North America have. We at Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, we do care, and many of us in Africans and other oppressed people do care about humanity and what's taking place with humanity. And we wanted to thank Sandra Forster, for taking the show today. And we will be back next week with a tribute to Bunny Ruggs and others. And we're going to continue playing some great music during African Liberation Month. And I would like to thank all of us for... I'm tripping right now. Thank all of you for listening. I can't thank myself. I do have an ego, but not that much of an ego. But we will see you in the whirlwind, and we continue with the interview with Javier.
In Northern California?
Well, he's somewhere in California. I don't know exactly if he's north. I don't know.
I grew up in California, and I'm asking you. You're from Mali. That's really ridiculous, isn't it? But
yeah.
Selena. I think it's near San Francisco in the Berkeley area, I believe. But
mm-hmm.
But you, this CD. Who influenced you? Who influenced you from the African point of view, and then what international artists influence you as a singer and a guitar player, first beginning in Mali?
I listen a lot of music, and since very little, very young, I'm interested by a lot of music, a lot of rock music, blues music, and written blues and rock music. When I was really 13, 15 to 35, I listened a lot. We know a lot of bands from England, from US, in Mali. At this time, we never go out of Mali. But we had this album who come from the vinyl. Some big brother go to Europe and bring the vinyl of the group of rock group. I know the whole group for 80s and 70s, 80s. Yes, I listen and I try to play sometime with my guitar, try to play some song. And influence me, a lot of things influence me. I cannot say just one name. But a big name on the for the guitarist was Jimi Hendrix in Africa. We know him around the 80s. Jimi Hendrix was very famous. We know him, you know. We know him too much. We listen to his music. And John Lee Hooker, too, for the blues. Yeah.
John Lee Hooker, right.
Yeah.
Well, look, let me tell you a story. I remember I was talking to this brother by the name of D-Blo from Congo, and I asked him...
D-Blo Dibala.
Yeah, I interviewed him many years ago, and I asked him if he had ever heard of Jimi Hendrix, and he fell off the phone. He was laughing so loud at me. He was saying that in Zaire, or at that time it was called Zaire, but in Kinshasa, they used to have Jimi Hendrix concerts. He said, like, Jimi Hendrix was, like, next to God, next to Allah in Congo. Jimi Hendrix was huge, you know. So he really laughed at me. He thought that was real funny, that Jimi Hendrix was, that was, that was there. Everybody wanted to be Jimi Hendrix in Congo.
I don't know the story about Jimi Hendrix in Congo, because, you know, in Africa, Mali and Congo are very far. Congo is very far from Mali.
Right.
Yeah, and he's in the center of Africa. He's another culture there. But in Mali, everybody wants the young musician who play guitar at the time, 80, everybody want to play Hey Joe, the intro of Hey Joe. On the guitar, everybody tried to do this. How the two string ring, the two string are playing, and the first note, only this line, everybody want to play exactly how Jimmy do. And it's not
right.
easy to know because he played two strings same time, and the string are his left hand, yes. But some play exactly how, like him.
Right. Well, I know there was a brother from Nigeria. I can't remember his name, but he played guitar as well. He came through here, but so I know he had a real impact. But the brother Baseko that you mentioned, the Ngoni, how much did he talk about the song that he played on your CD?
Yeah, Baseko is coming. I call to manage Baseko to play this on one song. This song name is Terere, and the name is just is like the sound of string instrument. It's like Terere or ting 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 Terere, and this song celebrates someone a young boy have a friend who play in instrument, and he say, when I'm going out of the village and when I climb the hill towards the village, from the hill I hear the sound of string instrument, and I'm sure this is the sound of my friend. I love him too much. I love too much his way to play the instrument. Is a young boy who tell this, because he hear the sound come from the village, and he is on the hill. Yeah, and to celebrate the virtues of a traditional string instrument, I write this song and I tell the name of the old virtues of this instrument who passed away, and I invite Tumani and Baseko to come to play, because in the song I tell their name. I tell the name of Baseko, and when I tell him, I try to organize. Okay, you go on solo. If I say Baseko Kuyate in the song, you have to go on solo. If you do the solo, and at the end of your solo, we must play together one line to end your solos, and this last line, we all three, Kora, Goni, and my guitar, we have to play this last line to end your solos, and that's
right,
what we
right,
do.
Right.
It was
right.
Yeah, and we do at home. It was great, and Tumani do the same. When I call his name, he go on solo. At the end, he play the same line, and we all play this line together. You can listen on this album. You can listen the part. It's like the meeting. The meeting. Someone celebrate, and he called the others to finish, to make the final together.
Tumani, I interviewed him many years ago. He's a kora player, right?
Yes, kora player. Best.
Yeah. So I understand you work with Eric Bibb. Eric Bibb, could you talk about working with Eric Bibb? Eric Bibb is an African born in America who's, I guess he's living in Finland now, but his father was Leon Bibb. How was working with Eric Bibb? How could you talk about that?
Yeah, I just met his father 1 year ago in Vancouver. Now he lives in Vancouver. He's like his son. They are really similar, same heart, same face, same I met Eric Bibb some 12 years ago, and because Putumayo make an album name is Mali to Memphis, I think, no, Mali to Memphis, it's in compilation, and they want to promote this album, and they invite me and Eric B. To make a tour together. Before we do this tour, I just met him. I met him in Sweden, we met in Adelaide, Womadelaide in Australia. I just see him. And one time we met in Vancouver too, Calgary, and he played the first. He played solo before me.
Right.
And this day was the day I got to talk to him. Say, okay, you play very well, and I hear some of your notes, like Bambara music. How you know those ways, this way to play? And he laughed, and we take guitar, we play together in his dressing room. And yeah, since this time we keep in touch. And one time they call us to make the promotional tour of this album, and we toured together in the same van during 1 month. And okay, and 12 years after we met, we try to, because all time when we see each other, we think about to play, to make an album together. Yes, I say yes. And we split, everybody go in his way. And okay, the last year, 2 years ago, we decide to make a meeting in Brussels for 1 week and try to rehearse, to practice together, to see if it's possible. And when we met for 5 days, we do a lot of song and everything go easily, good symbiosis. And we record in, he come in Mali and we record in Mali in the hotel room.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I cut you off. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, brothers. No, brothers in Bamako.
Brothers in Bamako, right. But his godfather is Paul Robeson, and his they were real close with Pete Seeger, who just passed away. And his uncle, I just found out his uncle was John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet. That's he comes from a pretty heavy lineage. He's a pretty pretty heavyweight guy. I'm really looking forward to listening to you and him perform together on that CD.
Yeah.
Now how have the African people and the Latinos responded to your music when you go to concerts? So, what do the composition of your concerts look like? Are they mostly Euro Americans, or is it a mixture of people?
You know, I don't know. I play just. I'm going everywhere, and I play. I don't play. I don't sing in. I just sing in Malian language generally. Generally, is Bambara or another language of Mali. Sometimes I have just one sentence in Spanish or one other sentence in English only. Yeah, but the music I play, people feel it. People feel it, and people of another culture feel this music. And everywhere I'm going, if it's a Spanish people, I play the same music, and they enjoy it. We was in Taos three days ago, Taos and Santa Fe. We go to the small village Taos, where is a lot of. Spanish, we are in New Mexico. I tell you, they love it. They love it. They like the melody. And sometimes when I say "Mi amor, qué pasa, pero te quiero," but they understand what I say. But the music, they feel really the melody and the rhythm. It's why. I have a chance to go everywhere. I travel a lot, and I play the same music.
Now, what languages do you speak? You speak English, French, and Mandinka?
Yeah, I speak my language, my mother language is Hassanke. This is Hassanke, and
okay.
But Mandinka, Malinke too. Speak some Sorai. I know some word in Keltamashek, like the language of Tuareg. I know some word, yes, because I'm from Mali and I grow there, born and grow there, and I can understand some word of each language, group ethnic language. But the language I speak a lot is Bambara. In Mali, Bambara is a popular language Malians speak. Everybody in Bamako must learn to speak Bambara and French too. It's why in the song I can speak some French. I make myself free to change language in the same song, two time or three time, to sing in a three language in the same song.
So the people when you perform in Senegal and in Gambia, you don't speak any Wolof, I guess.
No, if it's Gambia, the Gambian don't speak Wolof.
They speak Wolof in Senegal.
Yeah, if it's Senegal, okay. If it's Senegal, yes. I don't speak, no. I know some word in Wolof, but no, I don't sing Wolof. But they like, you know, people like music. Some are curious to listen over music. There are not a lot, but there is someone who come. And they like it. When I play in Senegal, generally I play in the French Culture Center. It's full. People on the floor, right. on the floor, and there are Senegalese, but maybe some are not. Some are Malian too, and some European people. It's a mix.
Right, but you know,
full crowd, and mix.
Well, you know what I find to be very one thing I always have been curious about is that the Cuban music was so popular in Senegal, and the Cuban music was so popular in Congo, and all over the world, and the Cubans speak Spanish, and their music was so big in among people that speak French and English and so on and so forth. Did you grow up listening to any Cuban music, or did Cuban music, was it big in Mali?
No. I talk about the driver of the big truck because he move on the road a lot. Okay. I'll come back with you. And the Cuban music was until now, but the 70, 80, the Cuban music was really popular in Africa. And in Africa, the whole Africa, I think, West Africa to Central Africa, and in Senegal especially, a lot of group of Senegal the years 60, 70, 80, the group, the band play Cuban music.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of group, we know a lot of group from Senegal, they play Cuban music. They don't play Mbalak like now. And during a lot of years, it was like this, all band play Cuban music in Mali too, but Senegal was stronger. I hear sometime one president of Senegal say no to the music, to the band, to play, tell them to come back to the music of Senegal. because they must play their own music. I think it's a single. It's a single one time who tells
you. Leopold single, yeah, right.
I think I'm not sure, but he's the one who say no. Okay, stop now. You have to play Balak to play the music. We have a lot of rhythm here. We have a lot of melody. We have a lot of stuff. You have to play those music.
Mbalak is an, okay. that's the rhythm of Senegal. Mbalak, right?
Mbalak is the way. Actually, since this time, the band and the musicians go back to the music, traditional of Senegal, but the popular one is the Mbalak, the percussions.
That's Youssou N'Dour plays the Mbalak, right?
Yeah. Youssou N'Dour is the king of Mbalak.
Right.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, it was a good change. They changed very well because everybody go back to the roots, and they take it and they bring it now and in the future and now, and actually in the Balak is the goodness music, and the musicians know the way to play this, like with the instrument, modern electric instruments, with the Balak was something great, rhythm, and the people dance, you can dance, you know, and in Mali, it wasn't safe. Malian music, the first band, they use a lot of salsa music, too, in Guinea, everywhere, in Congo, rumba, and Congo,
right.
it's like a Cuban music, but, okay. And we have some music who are like Cuban music too. It's not because those music try to be like Cuban music, but they are like this. They are naturally like this, rationally like this. The music, some music, Mandinka music, the way of the cycles, the music, the lines are cycles. It's not a music who change every. It's a music with a rhythm, a lot of rhythm, and the melody are the same who make a lot of cycle, and it's the same feeling. It seems like a Cuban music and some Mandinka music.
Okay, my friend, I think I've taken up. I would like to. I know you're on the road. I really like to thank you for this interview. I know I've had you on the phone quite a while. Is there anything you would like to say to the people of Toronto, Canada, and to the people of North America where you're touring now?
The people from North America I thank them to invite me. In the homeland, and it can be for me, it's a big honor for me to play for them, and to let them think about my homeland too, Mali, to think and to help peace, a wish of peace for my country.
Well, I look forward to seeing you at the Mod Club Friday night. I will see you there.
Okay, hopefully. See you soon.
Thank you very much for the interview, and it's been very nice talking to you. And I love the new CD, and I will be playing it on Uhuru Radio and on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, as well as Radio Region. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.